This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to the premiere episode of this Pod Blast. Probably not always going to be a Pod Blast series, but Pop Goes to the Couch, the sister show of Pop Goes to the Movies. I am JT, and joining me here tonight for the second straight year to talk Glow on Netflix are the first couple, I guess. Is that what we're running with? I don't know. PCBN, they are the co-hosts of Talk and Pop. They share the couch for Talk and WCW, and they're on each other's other shows all the time. That is Jennifer Smith and Timothy Capel. How are you both doing?
I'm pretty sure you and Scott are the first couple of PTBN.
We're like the grandparents.
The first grandparents of PTBN.
Well, Scott's like the grandfather, and I'm just like the uncle.
Sure. Yes. No, y'all are a couple.
Okay. Thanks for making it awkward.
I mean, we're first something. I don't know what it is, but here we are once again. And we did this last year before this podcast series existed. So thank you for having us on the debut of Pop Goes to the Couch, or as I suggested, On the Couch with Pop.
Which is one of the few sexual angles I'm surprised this Glow season did not explore. It was on the couch with Pop.
Right.
The rest is all there, though.
Yeah. What happened next season?
I thought it was interesting. It was probably the only one I'm ever on, but I'm going to kick off the series anyway. It was fitting because obviously we do Pop Goes to the Movies quite a bit. Andy Atherton hosts that mostly with an array of other talent. But I do think it was interesting to have it, or important to have a show that or a platform for us when we want to talk about things that air either on, you know, over-the-air TV or streaming options, which another vote out there was Pop Go Streaming, but not everything's going to be streaming because we may talk other stuff too on regular TV. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, here we are. And yes, for the second straight year, we're going to talk Glow. Last year, we broke down season two. This year, season three. And I feel like we're pretty quick on the gun this year, right? When did it come out?
Like 2 weeks ago? Three?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So we're on top of it this time. All right, I'm going to throw out a fastball at you both out of the gate tonight. Mm. Like right away. Okay. How do you rank this season versus the first two, Jenny?
I would go season one, season three, and season two.
Timothy?
This was actually my favorite. Mm. Season three is my favorite. Just behind that, I would say season one and season two, not far behind.
Yep, I'm with you. I'd go 3-1-2. And the reason I like three the best, and I'm really trying not to swipe it under recency bias, but I do think part of it is like now versus one, they really, really command their characters. Like at this point, like they, you know, they're comfortable, they're refined, there's depth, mm-hmm. especially in the ensemble, are just like a lot of other random faces that are just kind of there. We know all of these characters, we know their background stories, so when they pop in and out with stuff going on, we don't need like a thorough rehashing of who they are. Like they're already developed. We know Tim A's got her kid and is a single mom, and this is like that's all set up. So as things play out, it's much easier to be invested because we've already been invested. Also, I kind of like that they just know how to wrestle and understand wrestling now.
Yep.
Like that's a cool part of it too. Like season one is them kind of learning and some of them kind of shitting on it. You know, it's like, but now it's like they're just wrestlers living this life, which I think is a cool touch too. As wrestling fans, it just makes it feel a little bit more unique and focused for me.
Yeah, I like that they know how to wrestle, but also I really enjoyed watching them learn how to wrestle. So that's why season one makes it a little bit more for me, just mm-hmm. because I enjoy like learning montages and shit like that.
Oh yeah,
the awkwardness in the beginning.
I love that too. It's just the type of thing that it has a finite shelf life, and once we got past that, it was sort of how much more were you going to do with just the basic wrestling setup. And I've seen some criticism already that this season was so light on the wrestling, and that was considered kind of a negative. And I guess I can see that if that's really what the appeal was for this show for you. But for me, that's kind of not the main thing that I showed up for. And I'm fine with not seeing as much wrestling now that we're, you know, three seasons deep. I mean, let's face it, what are we going to do? Star rate the choreography of the matches within this show? It's just sort of, and I mean, they address that too. There's a good in-story explanation this season why we don't, as viewers, see as much wrestling now. It's that, you know, they talk about GLOW kind of being on autopilot. The characters do. And you get the sense that
they
have turned what started out as their shtick into this really well-oiled machine. So if they're pretty much putting on the same show night after night, and the characters themselves are kind of getting bored with that, then maybe there's not as much there for us to really focus in on as viewers. If it's not interesting to them, it may not be that interesting to us. So that's fine.
Well, I think it's a natural transition point, too. So let's talk about the Vegas backdrop, because they've now settled into not being a progressive weekly episodic show and just kind of being a rehashed stage show. So what did you feel about that transition from being on TV to being in this Vegas setting? I thought it kind of cool, because the idea of like them living and just like being part of this casino life was interesting to me. Like this casino family, how they all know each other, and like this show is here, and you got Bobby Barnes. Like I liked him just kind of being around all the time. And I can't think of her name right now. Sandy, the owner. Yep. Yeah. Who I didn't realize was Gina Davis. It's like episode 5.
Oh, wow.
What?
Now, in fairness, I watch on my phone on the elliptical. So, you know, sometimes it's not as sharp and clear to me. But, yeah. So, like, I kind of liked that aspect of it. Like, that they're all just confined to this one house, pretty much. So, to me, that was enjoyable. And I did like the episode, like, where they all mix things up and like put on a different show. And of course we could talk about the finale later, the Christmas stuff, which I like too. So, but what did you guys think of the Vegas piece of this?
Jenny, you go ahead. Indeed.
Do we lose Jenny?
So I'll go ahead.
I think we did.
If Jenny is resetting or perhaps on mute, we'll figure it out.
Back. I think she's back. Jenny. There
she... Hi. Sorry.
That's all right. We're good.
Hashtag Southern internet.
Oh, it's the worst. We were just peppering around the, I don't know how much you heard, but the Vegas backdrop of the show.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. It was like a real, like, sort of college or, like, dormitory type feeling. So, yeah, it definitely helped with, especially moving their relationships along, you know, as far as their friendships and things like that.
Yeah, I would agree. And this also was sort of an interesting contrast to that first season where they were all in like these shitty motels and just paired off and like had nothing in the way of amenities or even basic services. And it's sort of like, look how far they've come now. Mm-hmm. You kind of feel good for them that they've in a way they've sort of made it. And yeah, it's specifically this Vegas backdrop, this setting, and being around so many other different and diverse performers, I really like the way that it challenged the characters that we're familiar with and made them consider, you know, I'm a performer too. I see aspects of myself in this other person, whoever it may be. JT, you mentioned Bobby, who was a great new character, new addition to this show. And it sort of challenges them and makes them confront some things that they perhaps thought they knew about themselves. And the way that they respond to this conflict, I thought, gave us some of our best moments and best episodes of this season.
And it's an interesting time, too, like in Vegas history. I mean, I'm not like a super educated on Vegas history, but from what I could piece together, right, having been there a bunch of times and just knowing entertainment history, I think Vegas's original golden era was like the Rat Pack, right? So like 50s, 60s probably is when, you know, the original casinos all were built, and it kind of became the entertainment home on the West Coast and everything else, the live entertainment and stage show. And then I feel like it went through this arc, and you can feel it here where they kind of play it up, where it's like this old guard is starting to just realize that time is passing by and it's not that classic Vegas anymore. You get that feel a lot. Especially from Sandy, kind of like, you know, like where's the class, right? Like where's the everyone's in a suit and, you know, just and you hear some of that now even. But I think Vegas has had a resurgence now where it's just like another Times Square money making, you know, like tourist trap kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's rebounded. But this 80s period seems to be this lull before that rebound, before all the new casinos and glam casinos would be built. But it's kind of the fading days of the original old school Vegas. And I did look it up. I don't think Fantan was real. I tried to search to see if it was.
I wondered that. Yeah, I didn't delve into that myself, but I wondered. So
yeah, I don't think it was. But they do reference other real ones, like the Flamingo and everything else. Like those were all real, obviously. But anyway, so like to me that was interesting too. Like seeing them on the tail end of the classic Vegas days and kind of unsure what the town was. And not really seen as like a big viable, and like they're all trying to get out, kind of. You know what I mean? Like it almost feels like a graveyard for celebrities at this point in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like the way they're playing it off, it's like you're just kind of there, and if you're there, you're not making it anywhere else.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, and not being super familiar with the history of Vegas, as I think a lot of viewers might not be. You had the character of Sandy to sort of bring you up to speed on that, who again is played by Gina Davis, who is wonderful.
She is wonderful.
She, always wonderful, but really, really great to see her in, you know, anything in 2019.
Mm-hmm. She had basically had her tits out in one of those episodes.
Yeah, she was hot, right?
Strong, proud. Yeah.
Still got it going on. How about it? And she's just one of those person, such an unusual character where it's not so much she's this history buff, but she's kind of a throwback to this bygone era, and she kind of harps on it, and she's still trying to keep that ideal alive of this old Hollywood version of Vegas and Hollywood itself, certainly, through a lot of the performances that she hosts and that she sponsors here at the wonderful Fantan Hotel.
And also being a woman in a casino industry, it's probably sort of unique. And you see her sort of try to pass on some of her knowledge to Debbie at times, where Debbie feels trapped and she wants to be a producer and she wants to do more. So she's kind of a mentor for Debbie's character.
And she does make a quick face turn. Like she's kind of heelish early on, like kind of this like bitchy, you know, boss, but within like a few episodes, she's kind of just like a good person on their side, try to help them. And I think it is the stair walk with Debbie is kind of where things start to turn for her. But also like going back to like just kind of the family of the casino, like right down to her even knowing like the gigolo that hangs around, like he's just part of the casino. You know, this guy is just always there.
Paul the gigolo, he doesn't work here.
So if they are, it looks like they are going to be out of Vegas next season, probably. So if they are, like, I guess they probably gut it all out that they could, but it is a little sad to see it come to an end, because I really did enjoy the backdrop of Vegas. I thought it added a lot. So new characters. So we talked about Bobby, but not in full. So I thought he was probably the best new character that they introduced, and he really becomes a focal point once he first shows up. You know, when they're at a show and he's kind of roasting them all, and then he shows up with Rhonda to go meet Bash. And then from there on out, he's pretty much a full-time participant in these episodes. Did you guys really like what he brought to the table in that character?
I definitely responded really positively to him. And there were times that it felt like they were almost, I don't want to say doing a backdoor pilot, but sort of setting up for, they could almost do a spinoff with Sandy and Bobby and the, you know, just the ensemble within that Vegas setting, because they were such a strong presence this season, and extremely likable. So I'm not saying that that's a definite we're going to get that show, but if they did, I think they put in the work to kind of get me there in terms of my interests. I definitely took to these new characters that they brought in here, and was quite sad to think that we might not be seeing them again. I don't know. It just it definitely left an impression on me.
And Barnes was such like a, like I thought he was like an actual historical figure at first. Like when they first introduced him and say the name, like it sounds like they nailed the Vegas performer name, like Bobby Barnes tonight at the Sands Casino. You know, like like it sounds like an actual. So like I actually looked him up too. I'm like, is this guy like is he playing an actual like performer that existed in the 80s? And it's not. Mm. It looks like the guy who played him though was like, is pretty active like in theater or whatnot, because I thought he was tremendous. Like I thought, you know, he nailed, you know, the drag role he was playing and everything else, like his singing and everything. I thought was really on point, Jenny.
Yeah, I agree. And there was a one scene with Bash in particular that I loved, where Bash's whole storyline just seems to start becoming more clear. So, yeah, I thought that he had those little moments with several of our characters, with Sandy and Rhonda and, you know, several, Sheila, especially.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's really like the driving force behind the development and growth of a lot of these characters. Like, really is the linchpin. Like, if they don't introduce him, or if they never meet him, these characters, like, do they ever grow and develop the way they ended up doing? I thought that was that's a good point.
Yeah, he's really front and center in what I was alluding to earlier, where these characters that we love so much and have come to know so well over these past 3 years, they now have this kind of focal point, or almost like a lightning rod, where again they're seeing someone like Bobby Barnes and other performers that he associates with, other acts here in this hotel and casino, and saying, oh gosh, could that be me, or would I want that to be me, or yeah, in another life, maybe that could be me, but in the case of Bash, responding very negatively to that and sort of rejecting it, pushing it away, and completely the opposite in the form of Sheila. So just so much potential that they really exploited, I thought, the full effect there.
And right down to the end where when he finds out that Rhapsody's closing, he's like, oh, so the big room, like that was a good payoff where he's like, oh, so the big room's open now, right?
Yeah.
That was kind of a running joke, is that he's buried in the basement the whole time. And now maybe he finally will move into that spot. So another new character that popped up that was pretty dominant in the back end was Tex, JJ Tex McCready. So I thought the whole thing with him was interesting, like, because it kind of takes Debbie from, like, she kind of had this immature ex-husband, right? And she's battling with him and everything that's went on there. And then she's just banging, like, all these young hot dudes. But she's clearly interested in none of them, right? Like, they all bore her. And she's trying to present herself as this, like, and I guess there's another theme we could talk about really throughout the entire run of the show, of the season, is feminism, right, is a big part of the story here. So she really, you know, sees herself as a feminist that's, like, on the come up, that doesn't need a guy, that wants to make waves for herself and build a career and be seen on par with the guys in the boys club. And then she ends up with this hybrid of, like, this mature, you know, well-to-do gentleman, so, you know, I guess not really Southern gentleman, Wyoming gentleman. so on one hand, it seems like, okay, she's finally matured, and she's, like, with this guy who's older than her, clearly, but she seems fine with it, and, you know, whatever. It's a healthy relationship. It's just a normal, healthy relationship. But she's still battling these feelings of, like, trying to be this feminist moving up in the world, but here she is with a member of the old boys club. So now it's like, all right, well, I found this mature guy, but on the flip side, he just sees women as, all right, background noise, or come to the dinner and smile and crack jokes and look sexy, versus like actually weighing in and adding value to what could have been a business that it ends up, I'm sure we'll see how it plays out, but costs him in the end. So I thought that was a cool arc, is you really look at him as kind of a nice guy, and you figure, I thought maybe he'd be sticking around, and then she screws him in the end, because again, he doesn't show her the respect. So she puts her career yet again ahead of a relationship or perceived happiness.
Also, she's dealing with a lot of mom feelings, which is relatable, but it's hard for her. You know, she has to travel from Vegas back to LA to see her kid, and that's you know, places a toll on her. It's hard for her, as it should be, and she has to deal with a lot of crap along the way. And then, so I thought that her heel turn, I'm going to call it a heel turn because it was cutthroat, at the end, was pretty fucking badass. And, you know, she has to find a way to get what she needs, and she sure as hell does.
Do you think it was weird too that Mark just like threw in the towel and let her take this baby to Vegas? Like, I mean, I guess maybe we just don't see like Mark coming to visit or her going back with the baby. Like, but it's just pretty much shut up. Like, she's here in Vegas with this kid for like 9 months, mm-hmm. but, you know, without the dad in the picture, which I thought was a bit odd. But again, I think you just have to probably just play it out in your mind a little bit that stuff mm-hmm. was happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, the entire purpose of his existence is just to support her, literally be a supporting character for mm-hmm. Debbie.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things like, this is going to happen anyway. So let's not beat around the bush, fuck around with them having an argument and her making this happen because we don't have a lot of time to spend on that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So right. let's just do it. Fuck it. Who cares? He's not important. This is just the trajectory of her arc pretty much, and I did appreciate that new relationship with this guy Tex, as she nicknamed him right off the bat, where it's a very mature, very adult relationship between these two people, and they have both kind of been there, done that, right? And they're over the bullshit, they're not gonna fuck around, and yet you have to question at the end of the day how that sort of played out, and we don't know whether we're necessarily going to see Tex again. Like, was that the end of their relationship? What she
well
did?
I can't imagine that it goes for
well I gotta think that know? We may see the fallout of him, like he may become maybe. Like if she starts getting into the business of running a TV station, does he become a foil, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I gotta
yeah.
think he's gonna show up at some point just to close that arc, because it is left wide open like that. We don't know how he reacts to the news.
It, you know? It would be odd for them to have a breakup just mm-hmm. sort of off screen, because they did get quite a bit of time in the back half of the season. So yeah. I don't know. I feel like they're at least leaving that door open. And I kind of look at is this another example of Debbie kind of blowing her life up, sort of sabotaging what was and could have remained a really good thing. I mean, he was kind of implicitly talking marriage, and quite matter-of-factly too, again, because this is a very mature adult relationship. They're not being, you know, kids about it or overly romanticizing this long courtship or proposal or any of that nonsense. And she was just thinking, I had this utility to him as someone who, as you said, Jenny, was like arm candy in his, you know, meetings with these various executives. Meanwhile, he's been quite useful to me as well. Mm-hmm. And we know that Debbie is someone who is she's a go-getter. She wants the power. She wants the money. She wants the respect. And I'm like, you could look at it as her blowing her life up, as I said, or this could just be Debbie being sort of ruthlessly ambitious and showing that ruthless aggression.
So another theme beyond the feminism of this season was really centralized around sexuality.
awakening, this is a big
sexual
game.
Awakening and kind of understanding where you stand in the world, you know, in the world when it comes to sex. And they really, I mean, it's always kind of been a little bit there in the show, but it really blows up in this season. Just like mm-hmm. everyone's kind of feeling out where they stand, right? Whether it's Debbie just going on this binge after getting divorced and just living in this hotel and just trying to basically displace her feelings here, just forgetting about everything and banging. You get Rhonda and Bash trying to figure out what they are after their marriage. And eventually that leads to probably one of the more salacious scenes mm-hmm. in GLOW history. You got even right down to the gigolo with Melrose. Like, mm-hmm. what is their relationship? Like, all of a sudden she's happy just, like, paying this guy for sex. Right down to Cherry and Keith. Like, you know, what do they got going on? Like, their relationship has always been, you know, very animalistic and sexual in nature. And now they're battling with the kid stuff. So it's, like, all of a sudden across the board. And then also you get the lesbian storyline, right, mm-hmm. too, with mm-hmm. Arthie and Yolanda. So. Mm-hmm. Like, what is going on with them? And they're, you know, Arthie's trying to figure out where she stands when it comes to that. So there's a lot of undertone and in your face sexual stuff throughout this, right down to Ruth and Sam and their mm-hmm. issues, you know, where they're going to, are they going to, you know, the Sam and Diane, if mm-hmm. you will, of this whole thing, will they mm-hmm. or won't they? And it looks like they're close to it. And then things go awry. So a lot of that really permeated through the season. Did you feel, Tim, that it played well, or did you feel that it was heavy-handed and too much?
I didn't think it was heavy-handed at all. I think in a worse show, a lot of the sexual politics that were on full display could have come across as preachy, and it wasn't that. While we did get a lot, and it tended to be sort of unsubtle, it was pretty deftly handled, I thought, particularly looking at that relationship between Yolanda and Arthi. And you look at Arthi, who is a character that is very sheltered, very kind of innocent. Mm-hmm. And I kind of found myself feeling bad for her. And she's someone who is questioning, which is great. And Yolanda is sort of like, shit or get off the pot.
Right.
And
she's through that.
I don't
phase.
Know. I don't know. Maybe I sort of overly personalize that one, as I do a lot of the relationships in this show. But I kind of wish not only Yolanda, but maybe the show had been kinder to Arthi. And I really got into her progression as someone who was, we know she's extremely book smart, but very naive. Mm-hmm. And she's come a long way. She's a character we didn't see a lot of in that first season.
Yep.
Got some more dimension to her in the second season. And here has a nice little storyline and progression. And by the end there, it's so funny, the 180 turn that she makes. She, I am gay, and I'm ready to fight for the cause.
Right, right.
And Yolanda just kind of rolls her eyes, and you just know that's not the end of their story. So that was one I definitely responded very positively to.
I would agree. I wish that Yolanda wasn't kind of bitchy. I mean, she was... I mean, I get it. Like, I get it, but
still, yeah, I mean, totally get where she's coming from, but it's,
yeah, it was rough. You know,
it was rough. Yeah, I felt Arthi's a sweetheart. You know, yeah, come on. Is. At the end of the day, how are you going to mistreat someone like that?
Yeah. It was real tough for me as far as relationships, because I am a Sam and Ruth truther. Mm-hmm. Like, I need them to be a thing, and then. For the stupidest reason, you know, they didn't hook up, in my opinion.
Right.
Because they've already admitted they have feelings for each other. They both want to bang it out. Jenny wants them to bang it out. And then she's like, oh, you didn't give me the part in your daughter's movie? Like, God, just come on, Ruth.
She threw a full-on tantrum.
She did. It was,
you know, it was one of those, like, you see where she's coming from, but... she's not positioned in a way where you're really siding with her in that scene at all.
No,
I think the problem too is that she's struggling so much. Like, she's just so deep in her own head that, and you see it at the end too with Debbie, where she just feels like no one is giving her a chance to do what she wants. Everyone's counting her out, basically, right? So I think she's just feeling like, all right, you called me down here for this part. You're supposed to be in love with me, and your daughter is my friend, and you fuck me. You know, and then she gets home and basically gets told by her best friend, who's giving her this amazing opportunity, that, hey, you're never going to be an actress. Just give up. So, I mean, this is like, and you could see the way they set up that episode, how it's all piling up on her real fast, that everyone, like, she's the lead dog early in the season, right? She's kind of the one that's ahead of the game. And by the end, it's like everyone has adjusted to a new life, and here she is, still has the long distance boyfriend, still just playing the same character. Not making any. So I think the way they tried to tell that makes her look kind of shitty. And like Sam was just trying to do the right thing, but she was in such a fucked up place that no matter what tact he took was probably going to backfire on him. Whether they hooked up and then he told her, or whether he told her before, it was probably going to go poorly either way.
Yeah, he did the right thing, but she just, I don't know. I wanted it so bad. I mean, they had that amazing moment in the hot tub. Where Sam confessed his feelings.
He just laid it all out.
I was dying.
And that was like the second episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came like really early in the season. But I think that the show stealer for me is Bash and Rhonda and their hot threesome. With another
Tell me about it. Why?
Okay, wow. I mean, wow. Because All right, so Bash had been basically ignoring her, and she was getting horny, mm-hmm. and she came up with this scheme to try to get him jealous, you know, with Melrose's gigolo boyfriend, because all that makes sense, and it's totally normal. And then she starts getting hot for the guy, and Bash is not picking up any of the clues that she wants him to, and then he starts getting hot for the guy. I mean, I'm just like, what the fuck is happening?
He's starting to condone it. He's not reacting the way that she expects and that she wants, and he's sort of pushing her into it and getting pulled into it himself, and there's just a lot there.
Yeah.
Yep. He wants her, you know, to feel good and, mm-hmm. you know, get what she needs to get. And he, for some reason, can't give it to her unless there's another guy there. So,
and what I like about Rhonda, too, is how genuine everything is with her. Like,
mm-hmm. yes,
she genuinely just wants to make everything work. And she wants to be this proud wife of this billionaire that's, you know, she wants to be empowered like Debbie as well and have a say and not just be eye candy or whatever, a trophy wife. And on the flip side, she wants to be liked by Birdie. And then on the other side, she just wants to be touched, right? And Bash is just obviously not interested in her as a woman because that's not his side that he's on. So it's mm-hmm. like – and then what I think too – and, you know, Tim, I was thinking because I think you had mentioned something along these lines in one of the chats. But like the time frame this is all happening is very interesting from a historical perspective, right? So yes. We're in the 80s. We're kind of – I think this is supposed to be, what, 86?
Yeah, well, yeah, because right. They start off with that Challenger disaster in January of 86. And they do make it like a 5 or 6 month time jump within the season itself.
Hard. It's almost like 9 because I think
– Well, yeah, they wrap up Christmas.
Yeah, and I think the one before that, they're still just like starting the new renewed contract pretty much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I do want to talk about that too. I don't want to lose sight of that when you guys out of the jump. But so that's going on. But so we're in 86, which I think are we kind of on the eve of the AIDS stuff really blowing up. Like I feel like we're not fully there in 86 yet, right?
I mean, within the gay community, it had been an epidemic and a crisis for a long time, but. I mean, yeah, this is when it kind of – around the time where it really goes mainstream, so to speak, where you're hearing about it, you know, like on the nightly news, right?
Right.
And, I mean, this is – I would say we are approaching peak gay panic of the 80s, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where it basically turns into open season on LGBTQ people.
Right.
And you can see why – a person like Bash would try to avoid at any cost
mm-hmm.
some association with this massively stigmatized community. And let's not forget that he was pretty personally touched by mm-hmm. the AIDS epidemic in that second season, you know, losing Florian. So mm-hmm. I think almost more than being ashamed of who he is, Bash is kind of terrified.
Yes.
It's just this horrible mixture of repression and angst going on with him. That's just very sad and pitiful.
And hot. Don't forget that part.
Well, it leads to a hot three-way. So, that scene, it plays out pretty awkwardly mm-hmm. as it probably should. And I was sort of torn between feeling rather uncomfortable and a little bit turned on too, which Jenny is kind of
flip-flop that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You, Justin, what did you think
of the three? No, it was definitely good. I mean, it was well done, and definitely there's some shock value there if you're not thinking it through. I had been tipped off that a threesome was coming at some point in the season, and I pretty much pegged Bash and Rhonda as being part of it early on. I thought it was gonna be with Bobby Barnes. I did not see the gigolo coming at all. definitely didn't see him coming. I thought it was interesting. Sure, it was well done. And like I thought the hottest part, even before they went to the bedroom, is like, you know, Bash heating up and basically like, you know, doming them as they make out mm-hmm. and like telling them what to do. Like that was mm-hmm. probably the hotter part. to me when before they had it in the bedroom. But you have to wonder too what's going through their head. Like that was I thought Ronda did really well with her facial expressions as she's wants to really dig this, but also is like kind of being like, what is going on? Why is my husband grabbing this dude's dick? You know,
she nailed it. Yep.
Yeah, I thought she was great there. So that was well done. Do you feel though that they didn't? I think they just ran out of time, but that they didn't fully address more what happened with the fire and the spray painting. I mean, I guess it's supposed to be presented as just like, this is life when it comes to the war on homosexuality in the '80s. And this is just what was going on. It kind of pays off with Arthi, you know, putting the bandana on and taking up the cause. But I feel like we don't get anything beyond like any fallout from that. It just kind of happens. And then that's it.
I think it's one of those things that serves two purposes. One is the character development that you mentioned with some of these relationships, and also just to kind of remind us that, hey, this is the 80s. And there is some, while we are in Vegas and, you know, on the Vegas Strip where it's like anything goes, there are parts of the state that are very, very conservative and also quite reactionary.
Yes.
So I think it was one of those things that when you're going to be in that kind of setting, you've got to take the bad with the good.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious if they saved the money. I hope they did. They had quite a lot in that hat.
That's something we didn't necessarily get an answer to. Well, and also this was we were told this was like an underground type fundraiser. Mm-hmm. And I think Debbie maybe publicized it to the point that it exposed them more than, and we didn't see any real conflict in terms of between her and Bobby. But you wonder if there was something there. I mean, Ruth also totally no-showed this thing and left Sheila hanging. And that was something that I'm kind of glad there wasn't a lot of that interpersonal conflict between the women. Most of the conflict was driven from external factors, but there was a lot there that they could have worked with if they wanted to, or maybe if they just, you know, had extra episodes.
Yeah, see, this almost felt like a season where I think we talked about this last year, where it felt like maybe an episode or two too long, and they were filling time. Whereas I thought this was the opposite. That this maybe could have been like a full TV season. There was so much to explore with these characters and these stories. Like even Tim A with the back stuff, like doesn't get a ton of,
and she's popping pills.
That could have been like so much more of a spiral story in there. And there was a lot more to explore where this could have been one where they got 13 or 14 maybe and told a little bit more story in there as is. We don't. So what did you guys think of the time jump? Did you find it interesting, or did you feel like it was lazy, or do you feel like gypped at all? Like, or did you like it in the fact that they really tried to portray that? I think they tried to tell the story through Ruth's point of view that she's just been doing this for 9 months, basically stuck in this swirl of the same shit. And everyone else is kind of doing stuff. And she's just sitting here every night, putting her makeup on, doing Zoya and checking out. So did you like that, or did you feel like it was a little bit tropey and not necessary?
I liked it because it was relatively short. You know, we didn't do it like 3 years or anything. It's just, you know, a couple of good months, and you know, they did a good job at conveying how Ruth felt about the time just going by. So you didn't necessarily need to really like see all of that stuff. Like you said, you kind of inferred a lot this season as far as like things happening in the background and them not really addressing them.
Right.
So I was fine with the time jump.
Yeah, I was fine with it too. I figure if the conceit of the season is going to show this cast from start to finish what their commitment to this Vegas act looks like within an entire calendar year, then you sort of have to do it. It feels a little bit necessary that you sneak that in there. I mean, I guess they could have broken it into two seasons where, you know, they do their initial, 4 or 5 month run, and then maybe their finale is they get the contract extension, you know. But
or maybe then two time jumps, like kind of go into July, August, and then to the end of the year. I mean, it didn't really bother me. It did jar me a little bit when all this, because it took me a minute to figure out that they had jumped. Because the way they opened that episode, like, I didn't realize they were already at the end of the year. You know what I mean? Like, I forget how it starts, but the first few scenes do not make it clear that it was like 9 months later or whatever. It was like, I was like, wait a minute, did that happen? They did this? You know, there was something referenced early on. I can't remember what it was.
Well, they were caught me off guard. Go ahead, Jenny.
No, I was going to say they did that little like celebration for 100 shows.
That's what it was.
Enthusiasm waned, you know, until they weren't celebrating any milestones anymore.
Yeah. And it shows, it does the montage with
Ruth
taking off her makeup, which was nice.
Cool. Yeah.
It's really cool with I can't remember which song was playing, but they do one of those needle drops, you know?
Right.
Which I thought the music cues, by the way, this season were all pretty well done.
Yep.
That's the sort of thing that, again, in a worse show can be sort of obnoxious and too on the nose. But they're all really good this season.
And
maybe
dead on time-wise, too. Like, mm-hmm. And they're lucky that the 80s have so many great songs to lean on, so you know they're not hampered too much. Because they obviously time box, they can't go beyond the 80s with their music, or 86. But no, there were some really good ones. Gypsy was a good one, I thought, when they're driving into the desert. I thought that was a good use. There. What did you think of the desert episode? Did you guys like that when they go out hiking and all that?
I think it was second behind the finale for me, as far as episodes go.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm glad you asked, because that was my favorite episode of the season. Pretty easily. And I think because it was pretty like Sheila heavy, just in terms of her development, and she was a character I found myself just falling in love with this year.
Yeah, she's really good.
She I think has shown the most character growth of probably anyone in the entire cast.
Similar to the pirate in Dodgeball.
What a comparison.
I agree. She showed a ton of growth, and she was really good in that episode. And it was the growth for a lot of people in that one. Like, you get the whole, you know, kind of Melrose and Jenny finally kind of get over their issue, and you get the Seder stuff and all that. And Jenny talks about her issues and the killing fields and everything. So it was, I thought both were well done. You also kind of get the issue with the biddies there have their problems with the gay pride. Yes. So a lot comes to light during that. Also, Tammy's back problems come out. So, but it's interesting. Like, I think overall, they did a nice job of having these girls, like, get, and you mentioned this earlier, Jenny, get past this just being a job. Mm-hmm. Now the job is there, is that right? They wrestle, they do this, they do that, and actually starting to say, hey, we can be more than what we're being forced into being. Like, Jenny can be more than Fortune Cookie. And that really plays out in the episode where they mix things up and all play different roles. They shouldn't just be happy to be employed at this point now. Like, they are employed, so they should strive to make it better and not as before. And I think that speaks to us probably as wrestling fans, especially Tim, you and I, kind of long-time wrestling fans, where these kind of stereotypical gimmicks were always so commonplace and still are in some ways, but especially in the 80s, like, they really nailed the, all right, well, you're Asian, then you got to be a, you know, Kung Fu warrior or whatever, you know. Oh, you're a Samoan, you're going to be a barefoot savage. You know, like, that was prominent in that time. And with Zoya, right down the line. It's all very xenophobic. And that's just what wrestling was in the 80s. And I thought they do a good job capturing that.
And the stuff with Sheila, it's not particularly xenophobic. I mean, she's not linked to, you know, certain ethnicity or anything. Right. But she's doing this wolf girl character, which is an extension of her real, true, authentic self, you know, where they talk about the best wrestling performers are just when you have your gimmick and it's yourself turned up to 11, right? Mm-hmm. And that was Sheila's whole deal. She's kind of the Mick Foley of the group, right? Just in terms of her progression, where she discards her, I mean, she's literally discarding her outer shell, burning it, and what does she say? She says, it was getting in my way.
Yes.
Again, that play between the symbolic and the literal there, which was so well done, and such a succinct statement from her, where she's not like shitting on this and saying, oh, what was I thinking? It was such a mistake to be this wolf girl and for that to be my identity and how
she admits she was hiding behind it.
She was hiding behind it, and it served a purpose. You know, it made her feel confident and powerful, and it protected her. And it was sort of, at the same time, very limiting. Mm-hmm. And she also says in that same scene, there's so many things I want to do. And that's when she realizes she can do these things if she, you know, allows herself to be something other than or more than just, you know, the wolf girl. And that I found just very moving, just mm-hmm. that entire scene with her. So, again, not to try to over-identify with some of these characters and their arcs. It was just one of those. It hit really hard, I thought.
How hard did you guys want to smack Sam when he was hiding the heart attack, Jenny?
Oh, my God.
Oh, what a bastard.
God, I love Marc Maron so much. I just really do. And he was – how do you try to hide a heart attack?
Right.
I
mean, how do you have a heart attack and just spend the night in a hospital? And,
yeah.
You know, old habits die hard, I guess. And
why didn't he just tell her? Right. I mean, just tell her.
He just can't. Like, he just cannot be honest.
He broke her heart instead.
Yeah. It's odd. I'd be. And I guess
he's kind of freaking out too. Or
yeah, he's totally
he's now faced with his mortality. Like he's been doing the things that they tell you you have to do. Like, you know, you got to cut down on smoking, got to exercise, eat better, and yet he still has this heart attack. And he's mm-hmm. like, maybe looking at it in terms of my days are
right. Why bother, kind of thing. Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. And I mean, he doesn't tell her, come out directly and say, mm-hmm. hey, I had a heart attack. But in that finale with the adoption papers, which mm-hmm. was a pretty right. big turn for Sam, he tells her, you know, I may not have as much time as I thought. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't question it, which was interesting.
Mm-hmm. She probably agrees.
she's already come to that conclusion.
She's so, like, yeah, no shit.
So I want to spend time on the finale, but I want to just ask quick, how did you guys love the mud wrestling scene as well?
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was great. It was such a great Carmen moment too. Yeah, yeah.
Oh God.
Because you know she just was like been dying to do that. And you yes. can see their conflict when she's talking to Carlito about going on the yes. road and everything else. You're going to see the conflict in her, like, loving the girls and loving what she's doing, but just wanting more because she's so passionate about being a wrestler, knowing
yes.
in this world of the gorgeous ladies of wrestling, she's never going to be the top dog because just of the presentation of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So getting to go out there and just be this heel in the mud and help Cherry feel better and earn her money was like such a big moment for her. But then again, you see it at the end where she's basically like, I'm done. I'm going on the road. But you mm-hmm. can tell it's killing her to do so. And again, it's all part of, you know, where everything goes. So I guess we can transition to that because I also wanted to talk about Cherry and Keith, and that pretty much plays into the finale. So obviously Cherry questions whether or not she wants to have a baby. The stuff with Debbie makes her realize that, you know, she may not want one. Keith gets pissed. He leaves. And then he's gone for what? Probably a good 5 episodes or so, 6 episodes.
Yeah, that's a while.
Mm-hmm. He's gone for, he leaves in episode 4. So then he comes back in 10. So he's gone for most of the season before he shows back up. And when he showed up, I mean, I love the whole, you guys may know, but I enjoy like Christmas related episodes of things. I'm not sure if you're aware.
Is that right?
But so I really like that they did a whole Christmas themed episode.
Me
both
too.
Of the show and then within the show where they do A Christmas Carol. Like I thought that was really, really well done. And I love that they do it. And I'm glad that the crowd, I was worried they were going to have like the crowd shit on it. And I actually liked that the crowd never shit on any of it. Like,
no,
every crowd that attended their show was into it, which I thought was mm-hmm. a really cool touch. Like, they just never had the crowd just dump on any of it or say this is fake or bullshit. Like, they always enjoyed it as it was fitting stage show where it's supposed to be campy yeah. over the top. So mm-hmm. it fits well there. But I really liked the whole Christmas stuff. I liked the whole, I thought it was my favorite episode between the Christmas theme and then the stuff with Sam and Ruth and then Debbie, you know, Bash kind of spiraling way out of control mm-hmm. and just in this funk. And then as soon as he hears about a good business deal, like sobers up immediately. It was like on the phone. And I love when they just push him onto the screen. And they do the scene where, you know, she's reading to him. And then at the end, he's like, are we done or whatever? This go out there. I thought that was really good. And then I really like, obviously, when Keith shows up. I mean, that was about as close as getting choked up, I think, as I've gotten in the show.
I
thought it was really well done, like, when he shows up as Santa. And, like, it was just such a good moment. Because it was such a genuine, heartfelt moment, which you don't always get a ton of on TV these days. where it's not ham-fisted. And the only show I can really think of off the top of my head that was like that was Parks and Rec, where I had like a genuinely good heart, where everyone just was like nice and cared about each other and like trying to do the right thing. That's what this felt like. Like, Keith shows up and they're all so happy. You could feel how happy they all were to see him and for Cherry, because they know what she'd been going through. So like, I thought that was just a really cool moment. And plus, Keith has been awesome throughout the whole show. So like, seeing him flip out like that was such a shock, because he's always been so supportive of Cherry and of the show, to see him go into this dark place. And then the payoff was just so good, where he talks about adoption and he finds this middle ground and everything. So I thought that was really, really well done. I thought it was probably one of the one or two highlights of the episode. And I thought the ending was interesting, but we can talk about that, because we'll talk about season four in a minute. But what did you guys think of the finale?
Yeah, I dug the Cherry and Keith stuff also. And it was one that you really didn't see it coming either. Mm-hmm. You'd sort of forgotten about that subplot, where Cherry had been kind of spiraling since Keith left, and sort of gets her groove back, gets out of debt by doing the great mud wrestling scene. And you sort of wondered, is that maybe the end of it with them? And then he just pops back in there, and you're like, oh, okay, they did bring this to a pretty great closure here. So, I didn't, it didn't put a tear in my eye, admittedly, but, I thought it was, treated with the care that the characters and that the story really deserved. Also liked that Ruth didn't want to do the Christmas play. Like, it was not her idea. And it feels like, you know, one, two seasons ago, this would have been something that she had pushed for.
Even earlier this season.
Yeah, or even earlier this season, exactly. And she's just sort of, like, over it now.
Right. Well, she's just, you can tell, like, this has been beaten out of her. Like, she's in such a dark place that even something where she would normally love, you could tell this is like, she's just depressed. I mean, she's classically depressed, right? I mean, you're going to see it. Like, everything has been sucked the joy out of everything she enjoys or likes.
It's turned into a chore for her. And we've got Carmen playing the Undertaker, basically.
Yes. That was fantastic. She was so great.
No selling and sitting up and just the blank affect. So good.
Christmas Carol part was tremendous. I want AEW to do a Christmas Carol in the ring.
Don't say
sponsored
that,
by huh? Cracker Barrel. Cracker Barrel story.
The Cracker Barrel
Carol
Christmas classic. Yes,
it was really well done. Please. It was a cool, like, to think it was a treat. Like, if you look at it from a kayfabe perspective of those people showing up, you're thinking it's going to be the usual show, and you get this really kind of cool, special, unique thing that no one else is probably going to see. So, you know, it makes it unique. I did wonder throughout the season, like, how many repeat guests do they have? Or, like, was it a net new crowd every single time, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. And that's something that we're not necessarily sure of. Is it truly the same night, the same act night after night with a few of those?
I think it was for a lot of the time.
They did the Freaky Tuesday thing, right? Where they think it's their last night, so they kind of shuffle everybody's characters, which was fun. But you figure if that's going to be their last show, then who really cares? They can get away with that.
Right.
And same thing here, where it's you know, Christmas and the end of their commitment, basically, through the end of the year. So once again, you're going to try that. But I liked also that they didn't seem to have any bad crowds that we saw anyway, where they're professionals now to the point that they might have an off night, but it's nothing disastrous, and it's nothing that they're going to internalize and dwell on and question their whole reason for doing. You know, it's just one of those. They're, like I said, turning into this well-oiled machine. Mm-hmm. They know what they're doing, and they've got it down to a T. And yet the finale, the closing scene between Debbie and Ruth, where Debbie basically spills the beans and says, hey, we've got our own television network now. We can do whatever we want, but we've got to do new characters, obviously, because we don't own the rights to these, and we'll probably need to recast. So it's an opportunity here. Maybe, I don't know, are we going to get a very different glow in a potential season four, which is not a done deal. But
so who owns the characters, sort of though? Because that part I didn't get. I would assume Bash owned them. So is the casino own them? Is that what she's saying? Or did the network, the old network? Because, like, they're using them here.
I think the old network, and that might have been something that they actually got into in that second season where they work out this deal.
To Vegas because it wasn't on TV or something?
I want to say that was the case. But I would need to go back and find out. I don't know. It was sort of glossed over. So, yeah. But it's kind of like you look at a character such as Carmen, who came to a pretty mature place in just her character development, and we really might not see her again, which would be disappointing, but she got that closure that you don't see for a lot of characters and shows like this and these large ensembles. So maybe that's it for her. Same with, the Biddies, Dawn and Stacy, who were probably the least developed, but at the same time, if we never saw them again, like, would it really be the end of the world? Like,
right. Just, there's a few you can fade. I mean, there are definitely two of them, even like Melrose. Whatever. Like,
I'd hate to lose Melrose.
Oh, well, yeah, I know. But from a show perspective, like, she's still kind of lower end.
She's not vital.
So where do you see season four going then? I'm assuming there is one because they leave with a cliffhanger. Does Glow come back? Is it successful? Does Ruth cave? Does she do her own thing? Like, do we open and she's in New York trying to become an act? Like, where do you see things going from here?
Yeah, I could definitely see her running away, trying to continue on with this dream, and then deciding that she had already found what she was supposed to be doing and going back. That's really, and hopefully banging Sam at some point.
Or does he die before they kill? That was my fear when he started having the heart attack. I'm like, she's going to finally go there to see him and he's going to be dead.
Oh my God.
I kind of wondered if that was going to happen in the finale. It was sort of like Chekhov's heart attack. You do it. Now it's just this like dark cloud hanging over him. You're just like, shit. Well, that can't just be a one-off occurrence. Right. This guy has a heart attack and then doesn't tell anybody. It isn't really doing anything to change his lifestyle, at least more than he already had. And it's just, that's got to come back around. So that's a little bit unfortunate. But, yeah, season four, you figure it's probably going to be devoted to getting the band back together, in a sense. We don't know who all is on board with this rebooted Glow, with this new network, and yeah, it's got to be Ruth pushing back and then still finding herself reeled back in somehow or another. I mean, it almost writes itself. And certainly I would very much look forward to whatever they're going to do. But without that being a given, I guess
we'll get more of the push to around the homosexuality stuff. I would think that's going to continue to be a running trend here into the late 80s. The way they left off on that, I can't imagine it just like fades away.
Well, yeah, and one thing that's sort of funny to me anyway about that is apparently there's no bi people that exist in the universe of this show. But at the same time,
Bash is, though.
Is he? I mean,
they try to. Like, Yolanda pretty much shits on it, right? Because Arthi kind of basically tries to say she's bi.
She totally shits on it, and Arthi is like, I don't know what I am, which is, very much a thing today, right? I think most people are of the understanding, this is a spectrum. You don't have to be one team or another, so to speak. And I could sit here and harp on that and bitch about, by erasure, which, yes, is a thing. But I don't know. It's an 80s set show, and I think that attitudes towards sexuality being a spectrum and bi people even existing were not as enlightened as perhaps they are.
Oh, for sure. Definitely today. Not.
So I'm like, I don't know. I'm a little bit, there are moments within the show where I'm like, this feels more like a 2019 conversation than a 1986 conversation. Right. But overall, there are enough reminders there that, yes, this is the culture of the 80s. So I try to keep that in mind and just, I don't know, always have it tempering whatever criticism I might otherwise have.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we'll see how things play out Bash as well.
For sure.
As he comes to grips. So, all right, last question before we wrap up. Give me your 5 to 7 in order character enjoyment scale. You can do 5, 7-ish, whatever, somewhere in there, Jenny.
Oh, my God. Wow. I'm going to go with Ruth, Debbie, Sheila. Rhonda and Bash.
Wow, no Sam this season for you. He was marginalized a bit.
He was, saying, yeah. Mm-hmm. He wasn't in it as much as I would like. Mm-hmm. So.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to go, my clear favorite was Sheila.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe kind of in no particular order, I would say Rhonda, Tame, Arthi, Debbie, and Bash. How many is that? 5 or 6?
Yeah, that's 5. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to go, I think Sheila won too for me. Then Ruth, Bash, and Rhonda kind of together.
Mm-hmm.
Then Debbie, and then my man Keith. I enjoyed the first 4, and you could feel like, you know, it is such a, it was interesting that they had the man be the one that wanted the child. You know what I mean? Like, I thought that was a good twist on things, especially in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I thought that scene where they're in the hotel room is like extremely real. Like, I thought that felt very, I thought he did a great job, as you could kind of see his heart breaking as he's realizing, like, I've literally, you don't want to say I've wasted my years with you because it's such a shit thing to say, but you know, he's thinking it. He's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, I've been sitting here
waiting.
What
is this all for? Yeah.
And just being your, you know, your man at home, and I'm willing to stay at home and be a stay-at-home dad. That's all I want. And then all of a sudden you find out it's not going to happen. It's like such a kick in the gut. And then his return was just so well done. And as you know, he's been such a likable character, and he just has this one scene where he's incredibly unlikable on the surface. But when you look at it through his eyes, like, he's still just being himself, and his return was really good. So I'd put him top 5. I thought Sam definitely was marginalized a bit. But I think that was natural. I think they probably did it as like a, on purpose, based on how heavy he was in the first couple seasons. Mm-hmm. So I think it was good because you can only have him on so much without, and keeping him away from Ruth. Like, if you're not going to get them together, you got to fade one of or two of them back. So I thought it was interesting that they focus more away from them through a lot of the season. And then if season 4 is it for them, which, you know, we keep assuming every season is the last one. It's not. But if season four is it, then, you know, is that when they finally get together and move on? But all right. So any other final thoughts before we wrap up?
I didn't mind seeing less of the Ruth Sam dynamic for the same reasons you said. I think if they had beat us over the head with that every single episode and had it front and center, it would have gotten annoying. Whereas they're really able to keep it fresh, where they're serving it to you in pretty small doses here. So, I mean, that's why I would have both of them a little bit lower on my favorite characters list this season, but not because there's anything wrong with what they did there. I was pretty happy with both characters kind of taking a little bit more of a backseat this season. It was refreshing. So yeah, the way Netflix has been kind of cancel happy lately with their slate of original series, I don't think that 4th season is a sure thing necessarily. But
I can't imagine it's a super, I'm not going to pretend to know the finances, but it doesn't seem like probably a super expensive show to make. They're not exactly dealing with like big time stars at all. I mean, honestly, I don't think any of them really, I wouldn't call any of them A-list. I mean, they're great, but I wouldn't, I mean, Betty Gilpin maybe, but even her, not really. Mark Maron is not exactly banging the doors down of like a movie career as great as his podcast is. I mean, he's not an A-list star. Okay. I mean, you know, fucking, you know, Karma isn't commanding a huge salary.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're probably paying a ton salary wise. It's not, heavy on special effects. Like, they're probably, the biggest budget is probably on music, honestly, for all the 80s, the rights to the 80s songs. But beyond that, I mean, look at the set piece for this season. It was literally just in an old casino or whatever. You know, like, it wasn't.
So right.
I'm guessing if you look at the series they've canceled, are usually more of the heavy, like a Stranger Things has way more like special effects and everything around it that would cost more to make. Mm-hmm. Another show set in the 80s versus Glow that seems very gritty and simplistic. So it wouldn't surprise me if it's actually one of the shows that survives because it's so critically rated, mm-hmm. you know, does well, and it's probably not super expensive to make.
And I think this does get a lot more eyes and viewership than some of the stuff that they have cut loose. They can, while they have canceled a lot of shows with a devoted following, this is the one I feel like they wouldn't be able to get away with. If they, like, the backlash would be, I mean, just honestly droves of cancellations, I think, because a lot of people, myself included, are looking for any excuse to cut bait with Netflix because, you know, you got Disney Plus starting up. So you can only have so many streaming services, and Netflix is kind of getting kind of ratchet, not going to lie. Mm-hmm. So they need
ratchet.
They are. I mean, like, it's like I said, they're turning into the Walmart of streaming platforms, and just, I feel like they need that prestige anchor kind of show, and Glow is sort of it. If perhaps through attrition, I don't know. But it's a great series and reasonably popular and has a pretty devoted fan base. So if they just canceled this one like they have some of their other stuff, that would hurt them a lot more. You know, even with it being 3-4 seasons deep. So I would say bring it back with the understanding that fourth season, probably mm-hmm. it. We can make our peace with that.
Yeah, I'd like it to maybe like a little longer too. If they go 13 episodes, they spend, you know, 8 to 10 telling the story of Glow, and mm-hmm. then a few maybe the post world of Glow, like, you know, kind of where everyone heads, and, you know,
that would be fun.
Yeah, how mm-hmm. things wrap up.
Yep.
Any final thoughts, Jenny? Are you good?
No, I'm good. You said it all. And well, this pod blast.
It was a lot of fun talking to you guys. About Glow. Hopefully we kicked off the Pop Goes to the Couch series well enough that it'll keep being a thing. Hopefully we get renewed. Of course, check out everything going on our feeds here on the PTVN Pop feed. We have a lot going on, whether it's about sports, whether it's about movies, comics, convertible staff providing you with all
Thank
kinds
you
of great
that.
Audio.
Also,
the PTVN Wrestling feed is the OG. Lots going on there, too. You can hear tons and tons of audio each and every day on both those feeds. And, of course, PlayStation.com. We have some really cool written stuff as well. So follow us on social media. Twitter is place2bnation. Facebook.com/place2bnation. I think that's it. Everyone take care. We're out. Goodbye. Hello.